This hearing of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. Today is Tuesday, March 24th. The time is 3:30 p.m. We are in Butrovich, Room 205. Members present are Senator Myers, Senator Tobin, Vice Chair Giesel, myself, Chair Dunbar. We are expecting Senator Klayman to call in today, but he may be excused. We will see. Let the record reflect. Oh, you were there, Senator Klayman?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Thank you. There he is. He just popped up. Thank you, Senator Klayman. All right. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Mary Gwen Kawakami, the Senate Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Chloe Miller from the Juno LAO for staffing the committee today. We have three items on our agenda this afternoon. First, we will have two items back up before the committee, HCR 4, Myositis Awareness Month, and SB 276, Contraceptives Insurance Coverage. Then a presentation from the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. Here to present is Owen Brooks, their Director of Organizational Development. So we will begin with HCR 4, Myositis Awareness Month, for its second time in this committee. Last time we heard from the sponsor as well as invited testifiers. Today we will begin with a committee substitute, hear public testimony, and look to the will of the committee. So there is a committee substitute and summary of changes before us. Vice Chair Giesel, may I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee substitute for House Concurrent Resolution 4, Version 3-4, LS0706/N, as in Nikiski, before the committee as our working document.
We'll object for the purposes of discussion. Thank you. Here to give brief remarks on the bill, we have Representative Sadler and his staffer, Ms. Dolores Neal. Ms. Neal, would you please go over the summary of changes?
For the record, this is Dolores Neal, staff to Representative Sadler. Thank you, Chair Dunbar and members of the committee. Version N updates House Concurrent Resolution 4. House Concurrent Resolution 4 by replacing all references to 2025 with 2026, including in the title and specified lines on page 2.
Very good. Are there any questions for Ms. Neal? Seeing none, I will drop my objection. Are there further objections? Seeing none, we have adopted the committee substitute. Let's see here. Oh, got a text from Senator Klayman. No, not a question. Representative Sadler, do you have actually, you know what? We'll go to public testimony first, and then we'll come to you, okay? So at this time, I'm going to open public testimony on HCR 4. Is there anyone in the room who'd like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I don't see anyone online, so I'm going to close public testimony. Representative Sadler, do you have any further comments about HCR 4?
No. For the record, Representative Dan Sadler, Chugaikiko River, District 24. No, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the swift adoption of the CS. I support it, no objection, and appreciate the chance to do something for myositis sufferers in our state and around the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Are there any additional questions or comments on this resolution? Seeing none, Madam Vice Chair, may I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Concurrent Resolution Number 4, Version 3-4, LS0706/N, as in Nenana, from committee, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Legislative Legal has the authority to make any necessary conforming changes.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, HCR 4 moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Next up, we have SB 276, contraceptives insurance coverage, for its second time in this committee. Last time we heard an overview of the bill along with sectional analysis and heard from invited testifiers. I set a amendment deadline and we did not receive any amendments. However, there is a committee substitute and summary of changes before us. I should note we have online Matthew Parrott, a pharmacist from the Department of Health, who is available here for questions. And today we are also going to have public testimony. First, Madam Vice Chair, may I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 276, version 34, LS 1566, /N as in Nikiski, before the committee as our working document.
I will object for purposes of discussion. Here to go over a summary of changes, we have my staffer, Ms. Ariel Harbison. Ms. Harbison.
Ariel Harbison, staff to Senator Dunbar. Thank you, Chair Dunbar and committee members. I just have a brief explanation of changes for SB 276. In Section 8, the Medicaid effective date has changed from January 1st, 2027 to January 1st, 2028. The Medicaid effective date is the date in which the Department of Health must receive federal approval, or else the Alaska legislature takes back their ability to pursue the amendment. So we've added a buffer to allow for this process to take place.
Very good. Any questions or comments before? Okay. Do you have on that? Okay. I will remove my objection. Is there any other objection to adopting the committee substitute? Seeing none, the committee substitute is now before us. At this time, I am going to open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify on this bill? Do we have anybody signed up? Oh, we do have someone. Please come forward. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony. You'll have 2 minutes. We have a number of people online who would like to testify.
Sure.
Give me 1 second to set up my little timer here. Okay, please begin.
Good afternoon. My name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 276. We support the measure and thank you for taking the time to work it through the process. It's long past time that this go through. We agree with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists that all women should have unhindered and affordable access to all U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved contraceptives. While allowing for a 12-month prescription time period reduces healthcare costs, including physician visits, insurance refill charges, time off work to get prescriptions, we believe it also serves a critical safety function. Reproductive coercion is a form of intimate partner violence where a partner exerts control over reproductive health, including sabotaging contraception, forcing pregnancy, or pressuring a partner to terminate or continue a pregnancy. Such coercion may include keeping partners from doctor's appointments, sabotaging contraceptive methods, refusing access to insurance information, or withholding money for birth control purchases. Instead of exposing women to increased risks of harm on a quarterly or even monthly basis, providing the opportunity for women to get a 12-month supply of birth control will limit the opportunities for danger they may experience over childbearing decision-making. Thank you for this work on what could be a life-saving measure.
Thank you. I'm sorry, could you say your name again?
Laurie Morton.
Thank you, Ms. Morton.
You're welcome.
Thank you for coming in under 2 minutes. Appreciate it. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will begin, go through the folks online. First, we have Nancy Sheets Frymiller from Anchorage. Ma'am, could you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, my name is Nancy Sheets Freimiller. I'm from Anchorage, and I'm testifying in support of SB 276, and I'm trying to consolidate about 4 points that I think make it clear that this is really an example of a policy common sense solution that tailors the right fit for Alaska. And I was a former director of AWAKE. I'm also a former member of the Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I would just like to emphasize that it is there is an efficiency aspect to this, as well as saving money on administrative costs is one point. Another point to remember from an Alaskan perspective is that it retains the freedoms and flexibility for between the patient and the provider, so that in our remote states, people can work with their providers and have a sense of security and reliability. It also gives those in the remote areas, not only where they live, but where they work, the same access as those in urban areas. And it also gives low-income people the same access and reliability as those who have more resources. So those are my points, and I really appreciate this opportunity and appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sheets Freimiller. Next up, we have Mr. Morgan Lim from Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates in Juneau. Mr. Lim, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dunbar and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Lim. I'm an Anchorage resident now, and I'm testifying today on behalf of Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. CPAA strongly supports SB 276. SB 276 will undoubtedly improve access to contraceptive care by requiring insurers to cover a year's supply of birth control at one time. And it builds upon the Affordable Care Act contraceptive coverage mandate to ensure all people have meaningful and timely access to contraceptive care. People in Alaska deserve affordable and accessible birth control that works for their life, regardless of income, insurance carrier, life circumstances. Today, most birth control users are forced to refill their contraceptives at the pharmacy every month or every 3 months, depending on their insurance, when they only see their prescriber every 12 months. This represents a burden on many people in Alaska and increases the odds of experiencing an unintended pregnancy. This bill will have a huge impact for patients in our very rural state, people without reliable access to transportation, and those who live in rural areas face compounding barriers to dependable contraceptive access. In fact, 1 in 4 women say they've missed pills because they could not get their next pack in time. Access to an extended supply of contraceptives is particularly important for young people, survivors of intimate partner violence, and people who work multiple jobs or those who have low income, who are disproportionately Black, Indigenous, and people of color due to centuries of pervasive racism. Consistent contraceptive care gives people the ability to control when and if they have children, giving them more career and educational opportunities, encouraging healthier pregnancies, and saving on healthcare spending in the state. Given the enormous health and economic benefits, 29 states in the District of Columbia have already enacted similar policies. These states found that covering an extended supply of birth control is cost-effective and substantially decreases unintended pregnancies. Thank you for hearing this bill, and we encourage you to support SB 276 and move it out of committee. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Lim. Appreciate it. Again, folks, if you could please limit your testimony to 2 minutes. There are a number of people who would like to be heard. Next up, we have Brianna Campbell from Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. Ms. Campbell, will you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, my name is Brianna Campbell. I'm a resident of Anchorage, and thank you, Chair Dunbar, for hearing this today. I'm speaking in support of SB 276. I am also speaking on behalf of a friend who could not be on the line today because she works on fishing vessels for months at a time. this bill would certainly help her get the birth control that she needs when she's gone for extended periods of time. And I think it's important to remember birth control isn't just for preventing unintended pregnancies. It helps with health issues, helps with symptoms that people are experiencing. And this is something that would certainly make a big difference in her life, as well as many others that are on the slope, on fishing vessels, out doing research. Alaska has a unique landscape, and I think it's important our bills reflect that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. Next up, we have Ms. Laura Gaczynski from North Pole. Ma'am, I apologize if I'm pronouncing your name wrong. Could you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Hi there. My name is Laura Gaczynski. I'm calling in from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm calling in support of SB 276. Our constituents have multiple times over the last 5 years, time and time again, voted to approve abortion health care for women. They, back in 2024, already approved this as HB, I think it was 17, but I may have that incorrect. But like one of the previous women said, this is absolutely something that has been bipartisan agreed upon by our constituents and our voters. So not only will it save the state money by just enacting the plan that we've all agreed upon, but it will keep people safe, men, women, anything in between. This is, I think, medical care is a human right, and we should do what we can to uphold that. Once again, my name is Laura Gaczynski. Thank you for my time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gaczynski. Next up, we have Leslie Lindsay, also calling from Fairbanks. Ms. Lindsay, could you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Okay, Leslie Lindsay. It's L-I-N-D-S-L-E-Y, and I live in Fairbanks, Alaska. I did live for quite some time out in Two Rivers, which is 30 miles away from Fairbanks, and knew many people that didn't have access to a vehicle at any given time, and were unable to come to town to do basic shopping, let alone get reproductive health care. So I am strongly in support of SB 276, given our rural towns all over and limited access to the health care. So I am strongly in support of it. I'm 68 years old, but women, I was getting reproductive health care from Planned Parenthood 50 years ago. And having the access is what is needed to keep young people from having things that are unintended, and they need to, having 12 months worth would definitely be a plus for many young ladies and families out in the remote areas of Alaska. Okay, I think I'm done.
thank you, Ms. Lindsay. Next up, we have Ms. Jenya Peterson. Ms. Peterson, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dunbar. Hello, my name is Jenya Peterson, and I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm calling on behalf of myself. Living in Alaska, we all know that getting access to health care isn't always easy. For many people, especially those who are living in rural communities or working out in the field, as mentioned before, making it to a pharmacy every month is just not realistic. And even getting access to virtual healthcare is not realistic when you don't have access to Wi-Fi, or you still can't make it out to a pharmacy, even if you've had the opportunity to speak to a physician. Right now, most people have to refill their birth control monthly, which can be challenging. And, you know, sometimes can lead to missed doses. And when people are able to get a full year supply, it can help reduce unintended pregnancies and give people more control over their bodies and their lives and, of course, their schedules and logistics. This bill simply makes it sure that if a provider does prescribe a year supply, patients can actually receive it and plan out their lives accordingly. And then making access easier helps people plan their families, stay healthy, and can even save the state money for both the families and the state. And as a woman who lives in state, I respectfully ask everyone to support access to birth control or 12 months of birth control and support Bill 276. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Seeing any questions? Our final testifier is Ms. Abigail Bromberger. Ms. Bromberger, if you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, I'm calling from Juneau, and I'm calling on behalf of myself in support of SB 276. And all the other testifiers have talked, have covered a lot of really important points about why this bill is important, and I agree with all the points that they've made. And as a young woman living in Juneau, reproductive health care is really important to me. I think making birth control available for 12 months at a time is really simply the most logical option. Refilling monthly just to be really challenging, and navigating the healthcare landscape is hard enough without having to think about it monthly, which really looks like constantly. So I think that this is a really common sense bill and really important to Alaskans, and thank you so much for the chance to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Bromberger. Is there any, I don't see any questions. All right, that concludes our public testimony online. Going once more to the room, don't see anyone. So this time I'm going to close public testimony. So again, we do have Mr. Matt Parrott, from the Department of Health online for questions. Are there any questions or comments or discussion about this bill? Okay, Madam Vice Chair, may I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 276, version 34, LS-1566/N from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Legislative Legal has authority to make any necessary conforming changes.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 276 version N moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. We will now take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. All right, we're back on the record. It's now 4:08 p.m. We have a presentation here today from Owen Brooks, the Director of Organizational Development of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, titled Housing is Healthcare. Mr. Brooks, if you would please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you so much, Chair Dunbar. My name is Owen Brooks. I'm the Director of Organizational Development for the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. And today I'll be chatting with you about the intersection between housing and healthcare. In this presentation, I hope you'll get an understanding of common health-related needs for people experiencing homelessness. You will understand unhoused people's experiences with healthcare, what the public health connections are to the homeless prevention and response system, and how we use data for system improvement. Before I jump into the rest of the presentation, I just want to acknowledge that a lot of conversations are had regarding health systems, how medical care is given to people, and how public health agencies provide care to populations they serve, and on individual behaviors. Does somebody smoke? Does somebody work out? Does somebody drink alcohol? And that's people spend a lot of time on that in relation to health outcomes, both for mortality and morbidity. What I'm going to be talking today are the social and economic factors and the physical and social environment and how those impact health outcomes in significant ways, similarly to both health systems and individual behaviors. All of these are interrelated in to such a degree that a change to health systems or individual behaviors will not transform health outcomes unless other areas, such as those social and economic factors and physical and social environment, are also addressed. Quickly, you all know this. I'm going to go over it just because housing relates to every single one of these. Starting at the top, we have healthcare access and quality. This includes things like whether or not an individual has health insurance, a primary care provider, and adequate transportation to medical appointments, to pharmacies, and follow-up. Unhoused people have higher rates of being uninsured. That's oftentimes double the general public. Moving clockwise along the wheel, we have neighborhood and built environment. These are things like the quality of housing, which I will discuss extensively in the second half of the presentation, whether or not there's crime or violence in a neighborhood, if there are stores that sell healthy food, and access to information such as broadband or internet access. Continuing down, we have social and community context, which encompasses things like civic participation, whether or not somebody experiences discrimination, whether they've been incarcerated, and social cohesion. So really how well a person fits into the community where they live. Coming around to economic stability, it really focuses on employment. If somebody has adequate employment to afford their housing, whether they're cost burdened by their housing, food insecurity, housing instability, if they move frequently, are evicted frequently, or are couch surfing or overcrowded, and poverty. When people have lower incomes, we see worse health outcomes. And that it relates directly to education. The higher level of education an individual has, the better health outcomes they have, the better economic opportunities they have. Conversely, if somebody is extremely ill, their ability to attend school, to be present in class and able to participate in class and concentrate can be severely hampered by difficult medical conditions. And housing relates to all of these.
I'm sorry, Mr. Brooks, one moment. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Brooks, for being here. I'm going to ask kind of a difficult question, and I appreciate the emphasis on education. I think there is a significant amount of research that showcases folks that have four-year degrees have longer life expectancies, and it is something that drives a lot of the policy work that I personally do. But I'm really curious in this line here that says quality of housing, and I recognize and understand there's a drive toward getting folks housed, first step. However, sometimes I worry about the housing that those folks have access to, because that comes down to the quality foods. If we are using the resources available to us to help supplement their diets through SNAP programs or food stamps, but we prohibit them from having quick foods, that means whatever housing we provide has to have the ability to boil water or to soak beans. And that then comes into this idea of education of how to prepare those foods. So I don't know if you plan to talk about it or if you can address it here, but I really do want to dig in to this idea of the quality of housing that we are providing those who are houseless and homeless in our communities, and if it is actually going to meet the needs, the long-term needs, to ensure that they get the support that is needed or necessary, or if we're kind of just putting a Band-Aid over something. We're not actually providing the stability that is necessary.
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator. Later in the presentation, I will talk about the overall quality of housing in Alaska, and I'll dive into it by ANCSA region, and that's based on Alaska Housing Finance Corporation study, housing quality study from 2018. I'll also talk about a John Hopkins study from 2023 that actually tried to quantify housing quality and then compare it to health outcomes. Self-reported health outcomes. And what we see is poor quality homes lead to unhealthier people, or people living in poor quality homes have negative health outcomes. The quality of federally funded housing programs in Alaska is extremely high. Go to a supportive housing program in Nome, and you will see some of the nicest apartments you see in Alaska being provided to people, along with services that are culturally relevant and adequately furnished for kitchens. And I'll dive into kind of how the kitchens are in Alaska, because a lot don't have a stove or a refrigerator or a sink, which limits a person's ability to feed their family.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Please go on to the, please continue.
Thank you. I'm going to talk a lot in this first half about unhoused people and people experiencing homelessness, or people who are accessing federally funded housing services for formerly homeless people, because they have kind of the worst health outcomes and the most difficulty in receiving adequate health care. I'm going to focus quickly on the barriers and then look at the data about what those health outcomes are, and then talk about the strategies we have in place currently in our state to address those barriers and to begin to address the health outcomes. So these barriers will all be familiar to you from the social determinants of health slide. Again, the lack of insurance and financial resources for a person experiencing homelessness is major. If you don't have insurance, what do you do? Who do you go see? Do you have a primary care person? And if you don't have finances to then purchase prescriptions that are part of your care plan, what do you do? Do you choose not to purchase those? And transportation, when somebody doesn't have stable housing, the likelihood of them having adequate transportation to go to a doctor visit or go to a follow-up care or go to a pharmacy is enormously limited. If an emergency department is closer, if a phone call could be made to an ambulance, that might be done simply because they don't have transportation to go themselves to the emergency department or schedule a primary care visit, where many needs can be met. Unstable housing, if you are worried about where you're sleeping that month, you are not thinking about your children's medical appointments that they need or vaccinations that they need. You are thinking about the base level of what your family need is, which is, do we have to move to a shelter tonight? Do we have to sleep in a car tonight? Our family friend won't let us couch surf anymore. Medical needs fall far below in a person's calculus when they are thinking about their family's well-being if their housing is unstable. There's also significant mistrust from people experiencing homelessness of medical professionals. Spend some time in an emergency department, you'll hear frequent flyer or, oh, this person, and they'll name them by name, and everyone in the emergency department knows them. And it's because they show up regularly, not for healthcare, but for a sandwich or a blanket or a safe place away from a dangerous situation, simply to be warm or to get out of the elements. What that causes in medical providers in an emergency department who are really meant to be treating emergencies is a standoffishness with those clients who desperately need primary care services and housing services, which are often cheaper than emergency department services. And when there's that power imbalance between a provider who is just at their limit, running with a million cases, and there's somebody asking for a sandwich, there's a different interaction that takes place, and it can really foment mistrust from a client perspective. And then there's stigma and discrimination. There's an association with those individual behaviors about why a person might be homeless, right? They have a substance use disorder, or they have a serious mental illness, and it's because they've chosen not to take medication, or they've chosen to use substances. And that stigma and discrimination can be addressed through education of medical providers and education in emergency departments. But again, that is not the place for most people to be receiving medical care. And then there's a lack of coordination, not just between healthcare providers, but between housing providers, homeless service providers, and healthcare providers. Coordinating between these three can improve health outcomes and client experience. If somebody feels like there's a team behind them helping them figure out their family's problems, they're much more likely to engage with those services versus when there is no coordination. If they have to tell their story over and over again, it becomes very exhausting, and people often just choose not to go to that medical appointment because they don't want to explain the problem they've already explained to three other people in an emergency department who aren't coordinating with their primary care. And when health conditions worsen over time, people start to not engage in their health care plans. If you aren't getting better and you are going to a doctor, the likelihood of you returning to that doctor to receive more services goes down.
Mr. Brooks, I'm going to pause this for a second. I'm noticing we have quite a lot of slides to get through. And I do want to leave at least a little time for questions as well. And so if you're able, could maybe accelerate a little bit how fast you're getting through the slides?
Yes. I will let you know that when I timed myself this for the chair, when I timed myself this morning, it was at 30 minutes, not 45. So I will try and keep it tighter than that.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mr. Brooks.
So what does that mean for health outcomes? According to the National Healthcare for the Homeless, people experiencing homelessness are 3 to 4 times more likely to die prematurely. They are 2 times more likely to have a heart attack or stroke, and the life expectancy of a person experiencing homelessness is 48 years old, roughly 30 years less than the general population. They're also 3 times more likely to die of heart disease between the ages of 25 and 44. And according to them, 25% of people experiencing homelessness have a serious mental illness, and a majority of them also experience a substance use disorder. So we are talking about people with very complicated health needs receiving services in a kind of mismatched way. According to the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness Federal Strategic Plan, those red bars are the incidence of disease amongst people experiencing homelessness versus the general population, the yellow bars. I'll just choose one of them. Viral chronic acute hepatitis, 6 times more prevalent in an unhoused population versus the general population. And epilepsy, 3 times more prevalent. Being an epileptic and sleeping outside or sleeping in a congregate shelter is an inappropriate placement for that person. So what do people do? Providers build trust. Sometimes it means handing out socks for months before they agree to a primary care appointment. They center clients' decisions. Everyone is in control over their own health care and what services they receive, and they respect that. And there's a continuity of care. In Alaska, we have 2 amazing federally qualified health centers in Juneau and Anchorage, the Front Street Clinic and the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Clinic, where somebody can go in for primary care and also get an eye appointment and also have a dental appointment and also meet with a psychiatrist and also meet with a case manager who knows what their kids' needs are, what their spouse's needs are. And that continuity of care is really significant to improving health outcomes. That looks like housing first, where people are placed into housing with the supports they need to maintain that housing and reintegrate into society and be productive members and successful in their housing. And it means mobile healthcare services. We have vans, we have buses. Here in Juneau, we have a van that goes to the Glory Hall and goes to the DV shelter, AWARE. And they'll do STI screening in the parking lot in a private clinical room inside a mobile unit. We also have mobile healthcare services that will go to encampments and do vaccinations, right? This is both preventative and primary care happening in the places where people are. And then integrating social services such as case management is very significant in successful medical care plans and addressing that mistrust and stigma. And then what we're doing here today, advocacy.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. I just want to add to the slide, as the Task Force on Education Funding has also heard about McKinney-Vento funds and disrupting cycles of homelessness when people are in schools and maximizing the intervention then, we see
a significant and precipitous drop in adults experiencing homelessness when we address it when they are young.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Please continue, Mr. Brooks.
Thank you, Chair Dunbar. I'm going to talk briefly about the public health connections that exist to the homeless prevention and response system. And just before I do that, I'll explain what our organization does for the federal government. We are a Department of Housing and Urban Development Continuum of Care. I'll touch on those programs that are really doing well, like the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center and some other case management things in emergency departments that already exist in MATSU and in Juneau. And then I'll look at those housing conditions based on the AHFC report. So HUD continuums of care are responsible for four main things by federal statute: policy and planning for all federally funded housing and homelessness services, data and evaluation that we report to the federal government annually. We administer federal grants to housing and homeless service providers, and we advocate and educate. We set all of the policies for all providers across the state, and we plan the homeless prevention and response system, which is the network of services and housing options to meet subpopulation needs. That means veterans, single adults, families, and youth. We also operate something called coordinated entry, which is a prioritization of people based on vulnerability. So we have limited housing, funded housing programs, and when the most vulnerable people, if you are an amputee or in a wheelchair, you should not be in a shelter, you should not be living on the street. Those highly vulnerable people need to be prioritized for a limited number of housing units. We monitor the data and report it to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Our coalition is the third highest performing. The balance of state is the third highest performing in the United States based on system performance measures. And it reflects it in the bonus awards we receive year over year to increase our annual renewal demand. And it's not a reflection of us. It is a reflection of the success of the housing programs and the housing providers and the staff running those housing programs. As a funder, we don't just administer the federal funds earmarked for housing services. We also work with philanthropic partners and with the state and the Homeless Assistance Program and the Special Needs Housing Grant to really try and think of the ways that all of these funds are working together, because none of them are enough to operate a program successfully. I'm going to show this super briefly. I just want you to focus on the white box on the left and the green box on the right. This is some of the data we report to the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. This shows the number of households entering into the homelessness systems. That's households, not individuals. So there's families included in that. And then how many of them end up in that top box, emergency shelter. And then over, as you follow that line over, the percentage of the people who go into emergency shelter who end up in permanent destinations. The reason HUD funds housing programs is because those have higher percentages of exits. We want people to move on from homelessness services to their own apartments, to their own stability, to their own family connection and community connection. And we see that at much more successful percentages than emergency shelter. I'll also say that HUD does not, through the Continuum of Care program, give any funding to emergency shelter. So the only thing our COC funds are housing programs and services for people in housing programs. Alaska is an innovative place with amazing things happening that are actually at the front line of what's happening nationally. We have the MVP program here in Juneau and the HUMS program out in MATSU. This is about case management, who are able to sit at the table and in those coordinated entry assessments really talk about what an individual and household's needs are and say who is really vulnerable and who really needs housing. And if they come into the emergency department and they have a housing referral that's out, they can get placed into it. Without that coordination between emergency departments and housing providers and homeless service providers, people often disappear, right? Or we don't know where to find them. Or they leave a shelter and no one knows, but they're up for a referral. And having that coordination with emergency departments is really unique. We also have the two FQHCs that I mentioned, where it's a one-stop shop. People can go in and it is not an emergency department, and they are client-centered, team-based care models. And then in some communities, not all, we have coordinated street outreach very successfully in Fairbanks and some other communities. We have mobile integrated health teams, which have been really a big push from the Department of Health in the last 5 years. And in Ketchikan, I met with two amazing mobile integrated health team members who will go to people sleeping in the harbor on a boat that has no water or no electricity and talk to them about what's going on with them and really think about that person should not have a police call or an ambulance call or end up in the emergency department. We want to work with them and build that trust. And in Anchorage, we have the complex care shelter, which is non-congregate. We have the clinic co-located in Brother Francis. And if you speak to the providers in that clinic, they are brilliant, brilliant staff members who understand the people in the congregate shelter. And then we have non-congregate medical respite beds for people who are discharged from hospitals where they can have some space if they have complex medical needs to not sleep in a bunk bed.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Senator Giesel.
Sure. I just had a question about the Brother Francis Clinic. I used to volunteer there when it was volunteer. Who runs it now?
I will follow through okay. The chair. I will follow up with you after. It changed. It's no longer volunteer.
Yes.
It changed to a full-time provider, and then that provider changed. And the last time I visited was when I worked for the Anchorage Coalition, which was 4 years ago, and so I don't remember.
Okay.
But I will follow up with your office and let you know. I forget. It switched from either South Central to Providence or from Providence to South Central, and I don't remember what the switch was.
Gotcha. Thank you. I'm glad it's still going.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Senator Tobin?
Thank you. Because it is in my district, I do know that it currently is under Catholic Social Services.
The clinic is.
Not the clinic. The Brother Francis shelter.
Oh, yeah. The shelter always works.
And then South Central does the clinic work.
South Central. My nun used to run the volunteers in the clinic.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She started it.
The providers in the clinic are brilliant.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. The complex care, is that the facility that's on Fireweed, or is that a different?
It was the former Sockeye Inn,
right?
And it was a collaboration with the municipality of Anchorage, and private donations and the COCs to really do a kind of unprecedented model in the state, and actually an unprecedented model in the country. It is a shining star of what we could do with how healthcare and housing is related. A lot of those folks should be in assisted living, but they don't have the verification of disability, and there's not coordination, and they shouldn't just be going from shelter to camping to shelter to camping without some coordination.
Interesting. Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that that program is still going and being successful. I remember when we first set it up when I was on the assembly, or helped set it up, rather. Let's please continue to the next slide.
I'm going to dive into that housing quality that you, through the chair, Senator Tobin, was talking about. John Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health developed a system to rate housing quality and assess housing quality's impact on health conditions. It rated three factors regarding housing quality: physical inadequacy, so structural deficiencies, lack of plumbing, mold exposure, no insulation, the housing cost burden, meaning how much a family is spending on their housing as a percentage of their income in comparison to the area median income. And then poor neighborhood perception. Are there abandoned buildings, high vacancy rates, or crime? And they compared it to a national data set, Places, which is self-reported data set. And what they found was that there was an intense correlation between housing quality and self-reported health data. In Alaska, the percentage of homes with increased risk of indoor air quality issues, the top orange bar is the percentage with increased risk, and the red bar is high risk of poor indoor quality issue. Siri has the highest rate of any ANCSA region.
It's very surprising.
It's very surprising.
Why, I mean, that includes Anchorage, obviously. Why do you think that is?
I contribute it to multiple factors, some of which are old structures and airtight structures. We have extreme weather conditions, and part of that is we want no air in. But when you have a Toyo stove or a gas stove operating inside a house that doesn't have mechanical ventilation, the overall air quality of the interior of the house decreases. So this was done by HFC in 2018 in collaboration with the Cold Weather Climate Center.
Still counterintuitive to me, because what you're describing applies all over Alaska, but particularly in the northern regions, you know, somewhere like Bering Strait. But Bering Strait is the safest, and Siri, the Arctic Slope, and Siri, mm-hmm. you know, with Anchorage and Matsu, is the most at risk. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would assume, knowing that there are many of these facilities that are actually in my district, they're older housing stock and were built in the 60s, the 50s and 60s, versus Bering Strait, which is where I grew up. Much of their housing stock for families at this particular economic level are new and have been built within the last 10 to 15 years.
That makes sense. Thank you, Senator Tobin. Please continue, Mr. Brooks.
The John Hopkins study found that poor housing conditions significantly associated with negative self-reported health outcomes. Specifically, census tracts with poor housing quality scores had higher proportions of adults reporting fair or poor general health. In addition, poor mental health outcomes were more prevalent in census tracts with worse housing conditions, as well as poor physical health. These associations remained significant after adjusting for other factors, highlighting the independent impact of housing quality on population health. And this speaks directly through the chair to Senator Tobin's inquiry about kitchens and quality kitchens. The Chulista region has over roughly a quarter of all homes have incomplete kitchens. The ability to provide nutritious meals for your family is greatly hampered by the condition of your kitchen, as much as it is to food access.
Thank you.
Alaska has the highest rates of overcrowding in the United States, specifically in the Western Alaska and the Chulista-Anxa region. In that region, there are more severely overcrowded homes than just overcrowded homes. Severely overcrowded means more than 1.5 people. I don't know how you have half a person, but this is a HUD definition, per room. That includes bathrooms, kitchens, dining rooms. So more than 1.5 for all the rooms in the house. And overcrowded is more than one person. So if you have more than one person, when you add up every room, including the living room, that household's considered overcrowded. This, compared to the United States average, is the bottom bar, which is less than 5%. It's significant. And if anybody in that household has a serious mental illness or a substance use disorder, every person in that overcrowded home is affected immensely by those medical conditions.
Thank you. Please continue.
And finally, this is the last slide regarding the housing quality from the AHFC report. But this is the percentage of homes with a one-star energy rating. Again, this surprised me growing up in Southeast. The Sea Alaska region has close to 15% of homes have a one-star energy rating. This can mean lack of insulation and results in higher heating costs. Homes with one-star energy ratings are the least efficient homes in our state, and they can use up to four times more energy than a new home, which really speaks to the age of the home built. And one-star energy homes are often thought to spend more than $2,000 per year in heating fuel, which is an additional cost burden to people's housing. So what does our continuum of care do to address these issues? We look at the data, and then we change our policies, and we change our program design to respond to what we see in the data. Continuums of care are required to keep a data system to track client demographics and services accessed. The demographic data is self-reported, and the services are tracked by the housing providers. HUD funding for the data system is about one-tenth of what the data system costs. So while they mandate we have a robust data system, we aren't funded to actually operate one at the scale that is required. And a COC is graded on its performance. So every year we submit system performance measures, and based on that score, it determines how many bonuses we're eligible for and what potential increases to our annual renewal demands are available to us. I just want to reiterate that our housing providers, who are federally funded and who are often also funded through AHFC and matching funds, are some of the best in the country for system performance measures. And it includes things like increasing a household's income, right? We're actually very good. with federally funded and state matched programs to increase those household incomes, which then increases those social determinants of health, access to food and education attainment. So HUD, while wanting data sharing to happen, doesn't give funding for data sharing between other state programs or state data systems. And they really prioritize or ask for this to happen for five significant reasons. State-funded housing and healthcare programs have different processes for the funding and evaluation, and there is a lack of coordination between those systems. If you can provide housing quickly to a person experiencing homelessness who is highly vulnerable, you can reduce their overall medical costs, and you can also access things like verification of disability that can qualify them for housing programs. We also want to coordinate between healthcare and homeless services and housing providers so that we can improve the health outcomes and also the housing referrals. Real-time data integration leads to ease in finding people engaged in a variety of services. When somebody's receiving services from multiple state-funded or federally funded programs, we want to know who they are and where they are and get them housed quickly. And understand if they have a coordinated entry vulnerability assessment completed. And we want to understand the complexities of people's medical and social needs. We do this so that we can analyze subpopulations, we can address policy concerns related to healthcare costs, and we can start looking at disparate outcomes by race or other demographic breakdowns. And we want to know who are the costliest and most vulnerable subset of high utilizers. This can help us inform things like Medicaid 1115 waiver design. And finally, we really want to demonstrate a return on investment. We want to compare utilization costs versus housing and services. And it really, the ability to share data would allow us to look at how much we're spending on a person prior to them being housed versus how much we spend medically on them once they are housed. And this is, you know, helps us understand how supportive housing works and benefits both individual and population level health outcomes. So where are we going with all of this? Since November of 2025, we've been working closely with the Department of Health on a data sharing pilot, transmitting a single data element. And to talk about the complexities of this, it has taken us 2.5 years to share a single data element, to get the legal framework in place to ensure that privacy is respected. And the single data element we're looking at is Medicaid enrollment status. We want to know who is receiving federal and state funding for housing or homelessness services and is not enrolled in Medicaid and get them enrolled as quickly as possible. This has been a long time coming, and we are hoping to continue this collaboration, and ideally with an upgrade to our software. The current HMIS software is being phased out. It doesn't allow for interoperability, and to that degree, we've applied for RHTP funding to improve our data system and do an analysis of how it's functioning. And big picture, not just data sharing with Department of Health, but Department of Corrections. Somebody's being discharged from incarceration to an unknown location. There's no family that's going to receive them. There's no friend that will receive them. It's likely they're going to end up in a shelter. We want to know that before they show up on the door and are told by Brother Francis that we're full. And Department of Family Services. If there's a family that's at risk of a child being removed because of their housing status, we need housing providers to know that before that child's removal takes place. And so this interoperability offers a lot of potential if we get there. And finally, stable funding for housing and homeless services. A lot of the state funding is from general funds, even though it's listed in the mental health trust budget. And those general funds are always kind of up for grabs or reductions. Last year, we saw an increase in the homeless assistance program to $10.15 million. It was the first increase we've seen in a decade. It allowed for new applicants and new homeless service programs to apply for funds from there. And this year, it's in the budget at half that rate, which is very concerning to our programs and our providers who have small staffs and are working with the most vulnerable, co-occurring disorders, really challenging people, kind of moving mountains and doing the best they can with very little resources.
Before you go on to the next slide, Mr. Brooks, I have a couple of questions here. First, I'm just blown away that it's taken us this long to even share one data point. I have to say, and maybe we're talking about different things, because when I was on the assembly before COVID, I remember talking about HMIS and about data sharing, about tracking folks. And I mean, that's more than 6 years ago now. And it's just sort of baffling that it's taken this long. Or are you talking about, are the nonprofits doing this already, but the Department of Health hasn't gotten on board, or has the whole system still not gotten to where it needs to go?
Discussions about data sharing started in our coalition 10 years ago. Concerns about privacy, especially with medical data, are significant. And medical data doesn't really belong in HMIS. That is about housing services and social services, right? So we don't just want to import people's private medical data into a data system that's not meant to safely and securely store medical data. Programs can do it individually with Department of Health and Department, you know, if a program decides we want to do this with Department of Health, they've been open to that kind of information sharing, but at a system level, there's reluctance and privacy concerns, which has taken us a long time to work through.
So there is non-medical data that is being shared through HMIS, right? More than just one data point.
Yeah. This is our executive director of the Alaska Coalition, Brian Wilson.
Yes. Yeah, so for the record, Brian Wilson, executive director of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. It's hard to sit back there and not jump up, but Owen's been doing a great job. So, yes, we established statewide data sharing within the HMIS system back in around 2018. That's also when we started our shared system with the Anchorage Coalition and the rest of the balance of state. So, yes, non-medical information has been able to be shared throughout the HMIS system. The big change here is having the Department of Health on board to be open to sharing Medicaid data. And actually what we do is we export from the HMIS system to them, and then they verify off of their list of what the enrollment status is, and then push back who is and is not enrolled into Medicaid.
Okay, well, that's encouraging to hear that. Yes. HMIS is at least functioning, even if it doesn't have health data, because, yes, I can remember distinctly a decade ago or more talking about this quite extensively on the assembly. Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's particularly related to this, because we also have, at the education level, support staff who identify youth who are experiencing homelessness and houselessness and identify their ability to be eligible for McKinley-Vento funds. What is the intersection of that data getting to your system and also into the state system to ensure that those kids who also may be Medicaid eligible are enrolled?
Yeah, currently there isn't a protocol for sharing HMIS data with state departments. We would like to. Our software simply doesn't allow for it. And to Chair Dunbar, I didn't quite understand your question before, but I do now. We have a joint implementation between Anchorage and the balance of state continuums of care. So housing providers and homeless service providers can see where clients are going across the state between each other. But their ability to share it with Department of Education and Early Development or Department of Corrections or Office of Family Services is limited currently.
And to add to that, one challenge that we have is that the Department of Education has a different definition of homelessness. So that's why when you look at school district data, they'll report higher numbers of homeless youth than we will in the system. It's because they can count other living conditions as homelessness, such as like doubled up. And for the programs that we fund through the COC program, they need to meet the HUD definition of homelessness to receive a referral. So a lot of work is needed at the federal level to break down the silos of approaching the same population.
Thank you. Another question I had, and I apologize to my colleagues for being so Anchorage focused, but it is where I represent and where I have the most experience. There was talk last year, maybe it was 2 years ago at this point, about the way that HUD funding was being sort of systematically reduced for Anchorage relative to the number of folks that we had. That basically, whatever the calculation the federal government did, that if we had been Houston, for example, we would have gotten much more money proportionally. What was causing that, and has that conversation advanced? Is are we getting more money from HUD now? Do we hope to in the future?
So you're exactly right about that. There are comparable communities around the country that receive significantly more COC dollars than we do in Anchorage, and it's because of the formulas and the different factors that they use. They look at population, they look at how many homes were built before 1950, things that just wouldn't be as relevant to here, and that they don't take into consideration, like cost of construction or the cost of actually delivering services in a super rural place that doesn't have a transportation system or an existing service array for homeless services. We've been in constant conversations with our federal delegation about this issue. They share the same concerns. Just 2 weeks ago, we were up talking to the people at HUD who manage this program about different ways that we could either get waivers or have ways for a high-functioning COC like ours to pull down additional bonus funds. So instead of it being a percentage of the money that you bring, that there's like a floor level of funding that each COC can apply for to boost up that. Because it is a big frustration when we're such a high-scoring and high-performing COC to only be eligible to increase our funding on a yearly basis at about $200,000. You cannot fund a fully-fledged housing program in Bethel for $200,000.
Interesting. Remind me what COC stands for.
Continuum of Care. So that's the name of the geographic regions that we operate and the name of our organization.
Very good. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. I have a question that's not on this topic. Is that okay, Mr. Chairman?
Let's see here. I just want, before we move on, not HUD funding, but related to $10 million you spoke of. That was state funding, is that right? And it's being reduced in this year's budget?
Yes. So the $10.15 million, it's the homeless assistance program. It's in the mental health bill. A very small percentage of that money is mental health dollars, and about 90% of it is general fund. And so in the governor's budget, it was a call for a reduction to $5 million.
Okay. Very good. Good to know, and good for us in the legislature to consider. I don't think our need has reduced by half between last year and this year.
No, it has not.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious, a few months ago, I was able to visit Utah with Inseparable talking about homelessness and houselessness, and they talked about a program that they've really been investing in called Street Medicine, which is really about getting those primary care providers to folks who are potentially living on the street. And I was really intrigued because they use advanced practice providers or clinicians, PAs, nurse practitioners, to really help with that very first level of how are things going and can we provide assistance. Has there been any conversation here in Alaska in having a similar structure or model or potentially going after some rural health transformation program funds to establish something similarly? The numbers they're putting up in Utah, especially the reduction in need for emergency services, is pretty exemplary.
Yeah, thank you for the question through the chair to Senator Tobin. It's happening in Fairbanks currently with municipal funds, and it's being implemented by an amazing team of providers who are meeting unmet substance use disorder needs, counseling needs, basic medical needs in encampments or to people sleeping outside in very cold conditions. They are working with clients right in the street. So it's happening here. It is happening kind of in a patchwork, and municipalities are driving it. There isn't a concerted statewide effort currently underway to implement something like that.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It'd be curious for me to potentially invite those folks. I think the street medicine model is pretty incredible. And if we think about ways that we can leverage the best state dollars, I think what Utah is doing is something we should consider potentially, if we already have an example in Fairbanks, thinking about expanding that pilot.
Maybe we'll take a road trip to Fairbanks in the interim. Well, thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you both so much for being here. If you have any closing remarks before we wrap up the committee today.
No, thank you so much to Chair Dunbar and to the committee for having us. Earlier today, we were saying that this might be the longest presentation that's been given on homelessness in a legislative committee, and we really appreciate the time to talk about the work that we're doing.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you all so much for coming. Thank you, guys. The next meeting of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will be held on Thursday, March 26. We will have our annual update from the Alaska Citizens Review Panel, as well as a response from the Office of Children's Services. This will be a joint hearing with the House Health and Social Services Committee and take place in Davis 106. Thank you, everyone, for a productive hearing. This meeting is adjourned. It is 4:54 p.m.